find all the case information you need faster. Smart litigators rely on Bloomberg Law's broad litigation news coverage and our market-leading dockets. Now with AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expansive state court coverage. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.
Welcome to Cases and Controversies, a Supreme Court podcast by Bloomberg Law. I'm Kimberly Robinson.
And I'm Lydia Wheeler.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in the big fight over the abortion drug mifepristone. It was the first time the court heard any case involving reproductive rights since it overturned the federal right to an abortion in 2022, and the arguments were both predictable and surprising.
They really were. You know, some people feared that when the court took this case, it was going to make the drug harder to get, but I think that the justices, you know, gave us a big signal on Tuesday that that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, it really does seem like the government is going to win this one, but maybe we should back up a little bit.
Oh, right. A little background here on who's fighting who and how we got here would probably be a good idea.
All right. So this case started when anti-abortion doctors challenged the Food and Drug Administration's 2000 approval of the drug and steps that the agency took in both 2016 and 2021 to broaden the availability of mifepristone, one of which was to allow the drug to be ordered by mail. Now, a federal district judge invalidated the FDA's original approval and ordered that the drug be removed from the marketplace, but the Fifth Circuit narrowed that decision a little bit. That court said it was probably too late to bring the challenge to the original approval, and it tossed out that part of the lower court's decision, but it affirmed the court's decision to undo those FDA actions in 2016 and 2021. The appeals court said that the FDA had acted arbitrarily when it lifted those restrictions without considering certain safety concerns. And that led the Biden administration and the drug manufacturer to appeal to the Supreme Court. But, Lydia.
But.
But it really does seem like from the arguments that the court won't actually answer those questions and instead that they're going to dismiss the whole suit for lack of standing.
Yeah, there were justices on both sides of the court's ideological line that questioned, you know, how the groups really have an injury, you know, to sue here, which is required to bring litigation into court. You know, Justice Elena Kagan hammered the group's attorney, Aaron Hawley, on which one of the group's doctors had been hurt by the lifting of these rules.
So who's your person? I know you have seven of them, but if you had to pick one and say, go read that declaration, and that declaration is going to tell you why, you know, we're entitled to be up here. Who's the person?
So Hawley highlighted one doctor who she said was forced to perform an emergency D&C. Now, that's a procedure to clear the uterine lining after a miscarriage or an abortion. So the doctor claimed that she was harmed because she objects not only to the taking of an unborn child's life during an elective abortion, but also completing that process. But Kagan noted that there's a process to address what she calls these conscience objections. And she asked Hawley if the doctor went through that process and actually objected to having done that. And then Hawley said no. And Kagan said, well, that's pretty unusual.
Conscience objections, the way people with conscience objections do this is they make those objections known. At the very least, to be able to say, well, this happened to them in the past, I don't think you have it for either one of those doctors.
Justice Amy Coney Barrett also questioned doctors' claims here.
Ms. Hawley, can I take you back to the affidavits and some of Justice Kagan's questions? You were talking about Dr. Francis. And as I read her allegations, or her affidavit reads, she said that her partner was forced to perform a D&C when there was a living fetus. And she said she performed a D&C on a woman who was suffering serious complications. But the fact that she performed a D&C does not necessarily mean that there was a living embryo or fetus, because you can have a D&C after, you know, a miscarriage. So if that's right, I mean, I think the difficulty here is that, at least to me, these affidavits do read more like the conscience objection is strictly to actually participating in the abortion to end the life of the embryo or fetus. And I don't read either Scott or Francis to say that they ever participated in that.
Yeah, Lydia, I mean, I think Barrett's really homing in on this sort of I don't know, fine line that the doctors are trying to walk here, where they're talking about, you know, one of them talks about their partner, as you heard Justice Barrett talk about, who had to complete a procedure on, you know, what she says is a living fetus, but, you know, they don't actually make that same allegation, you know, and so she's sort of trying to find the line between living and, you know, no longer living fetal tissue. But I think it's really interesting for two reasons. First, you know, I think you're right that it signals that Barrett is in the camp of, you know, hey, there's no standing here.
Right.
But second, you know, Barrett kind of flicks at this idea of fetal personhood. You know, this is not new. You know, the Dobbs decision had some little nuggets of it in there. And this is the idea that says fetuses are people. And, you know, that's an idea that pro-life groups are really pushing in order to limit access to abortion and abortion drugs. So, you know, while it's not specifically at issue in this case, I think Barrett's statements really signal she's kind of bought into this idea. And I think it makes it more likely that we'll see it brought up in future cases. But back to standing, because we are Cases and Controversies podcast here. It wasn't just the doctor's injury that the justices were questioning. Some members of the court really seemed to doubt whether the groups had suffered any organizational harm that would allow them to sue. Their attorney, Aaron Hawley, explained it this way.
If you look at how our organizations have been harmed, they've been forced to divert resources from speaking and advocating for their pro-life mission generally to explaining the dangers of the harm from abortion drugs.
Justice Clarence Thomas, though, didn't really seem to be buying that argument.
But that would be anyone who is aggressive or vigilant about bringing lawsuits. Just simply by using resources to advocate their position in court, you say now causes an injury. That seems easy to manufacture.
So the justices also questioned the type of relief that the groups were asking for. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said she's actually worried that there's a significant mismatch in this case between the claimed injury and the relief that's being sought. Basically, the idea that because these doctors are seeking protections, that they're asking the court to block access to everyone who might want them.
I don't know that our doctrines sort of capture this, but I guess I see it that the injuries that the respondents allege, as you've articulated them, are a conscience injury, that they are being forced to participate in a medical procedure that they object to. And so the obvious common sense remedy would be to provide them with an exemption, that they don't have to participate in this procedure. And you say, and you've said here several times, that federal law already gives them that.
You know, Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar said she agrees.
I agree, Justice Jackson, and I do think it's relevant to standing. There's a profound mismatch here between the claimed injury and the remedy they were seeking. And you know, you can only
Justice Neil Gorsuch brought this up later to the anti-abortion group's attorney, Aaron Hawley, in a way that seemed to really criticize the use of nationwide injunctions, which is putting a law on hold for an entire country rather than just the parties in front of the court.
We have before us a handful of individuals who have asserted a conscience objection. Normally, we would allow a equitable relief to address them. Recently, I think what Justice Jackson's alluding to, we've had, one might call it a rash of universal injunctions or vacatures. And this case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action.
Okay, so we've got Barrett, Thomas, Gorsuch, presumably the liberal justices on standing. That's where a lot of the, you know, argument was. But one thing that surprised me was that there was really little conversation about the merits of, you know, the challenges that are actually before the court.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there was a striking moment between Justice Samuel Alito and the drug manufacturer's attorney, Jessica Ellsworth.
During the questioning of the Solicitor General, the statement was made that no court has ever previously second-guessed the FDA's judgment about access to a drug, right?
That's correct.
You think the FDA is infallible?
No, Your Honor. We don't think that at all. And we don't think that question is really teed up in any way in this case.
Yeah, it was a question Justice Jackson seemed to clap back at later in her question to Ellsworth.
So you were asked if the agency is infallible, and I guess I'm wondering about the flip side, which is, do you think that courts have specialized scientific knowledge with respect to pharmaceuticals? And as a company that has pharmaceuticals, do you have concerns about judges parsing medical and scientific studies?
Ellsworth was like, yeah, that's definitely a concern. You know, that's a problem with this whole suit, is that it could open the door for people to second guess the FDA's expert judgment on what kind of conditions need to be in place in order to ensure a drug is being used safely.
Right. And so even though it seems like the court is going to keep mifepristone available pretty broadly, I did think it was interesting that at least two justices asked if the Comstock Act could stop women from being able to get these drugs by mail. That's a law that, you know, bans mailing of, quote, obscene or indecent materials and, some argue, abortion drugs.
Shouldn't the FDA have at least considered the application of 18 U.S.C. 1461?
So I think that the Comstock provisions don't fall within FDA's lane.
Justice Thomas also asked Ellsworth about this Comstock Act, and it seemed to signal that maybe he's inviting future challenges over this old law, which hasn't been enforced in decades.
Yeah, we'll watch that one.
Yeah, definitely something to keep an eye out. But, you know, one thing I wanted to talk about, Kimberly, that we haven't yet mentioned was that this whole case was argued by women, which is pretty unusual.
Yeah, it's definitely rare since male attorneys at the Supreme Court vastly outnumber their female counterparts. But I looked at the numbers so far this term and found that female lawyers have actually made unusually frequent appearances at the court this term. And, you know, they've argued about a third of the cases so far, and that's well above the like 12 to 24% that we have seen in recent terms.
Woo, way to go, ladies.
Well, I don't know. Don't get too excited. Attorneys that I talked to said that this is really a short-term gain. And, you know, we really need to see several terms of this to, you know that that's a trend that's going to hold. And also, you know, a lot of people noted that the diversity that there is this term has been driven largely by government entities. And that's, you know, attorneys appearing on behalf of the federal and state governments. And that there's still a very large gender gap when it comes to attorneys that the law firms send to the lectern.
Yeah, it's definitely something that is pretty noticeable when you're, you know, sitting in the gallery and seeing kind of case after case, week after week.
Yeah, I remember this one time. It was a few terms ago now, but, you know, the court issues these day call sheets and it lists all the attorneys who were on there. And that day there were more Jonathans arguing at the court than there were women.
Well, before we go, let's talk about another case that the justices heard back actually in October that came up again this week. So, you know, we had a little bit of news today, but not from the Supreme Court on that, right, Kimberly? So what happened?
Yeah, no, we actually haven't heard anything from the court since October. This is a redistricting dispute out of South Carolina in which Black voters said that they were sorted on the base of their race. A three-judge district court panel back in 2023 agreed and said that there was really striking evidence that, you know, the GOP legislators had acted based on race. And that issue is currently before the Supreme Court. Now, both parties said, you know, like, there's an election going on, so time is of the essence. And they asked the Supreme Court to issue a ruling by January 1st. You'll note that it's
April.
You'll note that it's past April, January 1st. And so we haven't heard anything from the court, no opinion and really nothing about why it's taking them so long. And that actually led the legislators to kind of poke at the justices. They said, you know, like,
hello.
Hey, remember us? Like, we know you're busy, but like, hey.
We kind of need you to say something on this.
And they had asked the Supreme Court to, you know, basically, like, if you're not going to give us an opinion, at least just stay the lower court's remedial decision so that we don't have to draw up a new map, considering that, you know, like, the primary elections, you know, happening pretty soon. And we got to get these ballots out. So the Supreme Court didn't do anything. And so the district court entered a ruling finally just saying, like, look, all right, you know, there are these looming deadlines that are quickly approaching the Supreme Court. I don't know, they're napping or something. And we're going to have to go ahead and allow the legislature to use this map again. It's going to be the second time that these maps are going to be in use for a map that the lower court said was unconstitutional. So, you know, this is a Supreme Court podcast, so it's weird for us to talk about the Supreme Court not doing anything. But, you know, I think that's had some implications here.
Interesting. Well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode. We'll be back next week. Until then, you can follow along with all the latest Supreme Court news at news.bloomberglaw.com.
Attention, smart litigators. When it comes to executing your case strategy, Bloomberg Law's continuous innovation is your secret weapon. And now we're taking it up a notch. Introducing enhanced docket features with AI-driven search and analytics, lightning-fast customized alerts, and expanded state court docket coverage. Plus, we've substantially increased our litigation news coverage, so you'll never miss a beat. Don't wait. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com today and get everything you need to secure big wins.